Gata on opening a sutra. The Dharma incomparably profound and infinitely subtle is rarely encountered even in millions of ages. Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. May we completely realize the Tathagata's true meaning.
So, good morning, everybody.
Welcome. Good morning.
So, I'm going to give a talk I gave a few weeks ago on what is Zen. And I thought it'd just be appropriate to do that today. And actually, I've been corresponding with Adam about it. I think he wants to put it on the site. So it's given me another chance to kind of go through it and see what I want to alter. Anyway, so let me do that. So this begins with a quote from Hakuin. A special teaching without scriptures, beyond words and letters, pointing to the mind essence of man, seeing directly into one's nature, attaining enlightenment. Several years ago, I was asked to speak about Zen as part of an interfaith panel discussion at a local high school. I found it to be uniquely challenging to present the basic concepts of our way in a manner that would make sense to young inquiring minds. I think one of the great barriers to reaching a broader audience for Zen is that it can seem incomprehensible, mystical, and inscrutable because of the limitations of language, although that is far from the truth. Perhaps one consequence of that relatively obscure appearance is that, generally speaking, it is a barrier to persons who aren't highly educated and comfortable with our relatively opaque descriptions and complex metaphorical language. As a result, Zen in America tends to draw a high percentage of its students from the intelligentsia, who aren't deterred by this intimidating linguistic barrier. In fact, this is a dilemma that's an ancient one, going back to Shakyamuni Buddha and beyond. The experience of awakening to true nature, of seeing this great reality as it really is, of entering profound non-separation with the whole universe, simply cannot be expressed in words with any fidelity to the actual experience. Just as we cannot adequately describe the color red to a blind person, or the taste of a fresh June strawberry to someone who has no sense of taste. This very same problem arises when we begin to examine the question, what is Zen? How do we talk about something that is beyond words and letters, seeing directly into the mind essence of man? In essence, what Hakuin is saying is that Zen is fundamentally a process of profound inward-facing inquiry. Most of us begin that inquiry in response to a question. The question can vary from person to person, but it is always one of the great existential questions. What is life all about? Who am I? What is my relationship to the universe? What is my true nature? Why do I suffer so in my life? It is the question that provides the impetus for our inquiry, our practice. Of course, the question isn't always something we consciously formulate and can articulate. It can be far more amorphous, such as having the feeling of being disconnected from the world around us, or sense that our suffering isn't inevitable, that there is a greater possibility for our lives. At the early stage of our practice, our nascent impulse towards practice is often strengthened by reading about Zen. While ours is a practice that is beyond words and letters, there is a tremendous amount written about Zen. And I suspect that most people in this culture have their first encounter with Zen through the written word. That's quite all right. Reading about Zen can inform and deepen our impulse to practice. However, we must also very clearly understand that reading about Zen is not Zen. Even if we read every book about Zen, we will still be light years from ever understanding Zen if we don't also engage in the work of looking into the mind essence and seeing directly into our own nature. We must assiduously pursue that inquiry, and the method through which we must pursue that is Zazen, Zen meditation. On his deathbed, the Buddha gave us the teaching of Atta-dipa. Look within. You are the light itself. Rely on yourself. Do not rely on others. The Dharma is the light. Rely on the Dharma. Do not rely on anything other than the Dharma. Whether we sit shikantaza, count our breaths, or do koan study, we cannot have Zen without Zazen, without the inquiry, without looking deeply into our own mind. Ultimately, we must be willing to spend years on this inward journey, practicing with great diligence, if we are to see the truth of what Zen is all about. No one can do that work for us. No teacher can give us anything that we don't already have. We must discover it for ourselves through all of the trials and tribulations that arise over the course of our lifetime of practice. However, while the Buddha says we must rely on ourselves, it does not mean we can do this practice alone and without the guidance of a teacher or the presence of a community, a Sangha. The three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha must be present for there to be Zen. There is a reason that we refer to them as treasures. They are the elements which must be present to guide and sustain our practice. When any one of these pillars of practice is missing, the whole structure is unsound. In this context, I believe that Buddha refers both to our inherent, but as yet unawakened Buddha nature, and to the presence and guidance of a teacher. By a teacher, I mean someone who has rigorously pursued this Zen path, usually for several decades, under the guidance of their teacher. Ultimately, through the process of Dharma transmission, that teacher has acknowledged that their student has realized their true nature and that they are ready to teach others. This process of transmission has been the means of preserving the authenticity of the teachings, the Dharma, for 2,500 years. Now, I know there have been times and places where the integrity of this transmission process has been questionable, as well as instances where teachers have behaved in manners that were harmful and contrary to the Zen precepts, causing some people to question the authenticity of their teaching authority. I am also aware that there are persons who therefore question the validity of Zen transmission and are reticent to engage with any teacher. However, Dogen Zenji taught that doing Zazen without the guidance of a teacher was worse than not sitting at all, and I believe there's a great deal of truth in that viewpoint. The pitfalls along the path of practice are numerous, and simultaneously they can be very subtle. We cannot see the webs that are skillfully woven by our own ego. We cannot do the work of loosening our attachments and delusions alone. We must have the guidance of a teacher. The fact that there have been flaws in the transmission process and that a small percentage of teachers have behaved unconscionably does not negate the fact that the vast majority of transmissions are authentic and the vast majority of teachers are highly scrupulous persons who work diligently to maintain the precepts in their lives and to convey them to others. However, that doesn't mean that a student should abandon caution and good common sense when entering the relationship with a teacher. Another whole talk could be written on this subject, but for the purposes of this discussion, I am reminded of what my teacher, Steph Barragato, used to say, never give your power away. Be careful. Vet the teacher thoroughly. Find a place to practice where you feel comfortable and safe. That is absolutely essential. Don't settle for less. If you want to see what Zen is all about, you must ultimately begin to practice with a teacher who has received Dharma transmission in a recognized lineage. Then gradually, as the practice deepens over time, the bond of trust between teacher and student should grow so that the powerful synergy of teaching and practice emerges, until in the later stages of practice, the distinction between the teacher and the student vanishes. The term Dharma is variously applied to the formal teachings of Buddhism and to the path of practice that we follow. However, while our practices have evolved over the time that has passed since the Buddha was alive, in Zen particularly, they are a dynamic entity that needs to respond to the conditions of time, place, and person. It is part of the job of Zen teachers to assure that our practice maintains its relevance, that our forms do not become stagnant, falling into lackluster rote repetition. True Zen must be alive, continually challenging students, dragging them out of their comfort zone, and guarding against their forming attachments. When sutra study became the dominant form of practice in China, Bodhidharma responded by facing a wall for 9 years, asserting the primary importance of Zazen, seated Zen meditation. Perhaps for Americans who have a tendency to favor informality over formal rigor, and whose iconoclastic tendencies cause us to shy away from devotional practice, those teachers who are maintaining a precise liturgical practice are providing the right medicine for this time and place. On the other hand, if attachment to form begins to become widespread, perhaps wild mountain Zen, that is more influenced by our Taoist roots, will be called for. If our Zen practice is authentic, it will never allow us to become in a place of comfort where our ego can abide and set its roots down. Our teachers and ultimately we ourselves must constantly dig down and tear those roots out. Zen is a tree that must constantly blow about freely in the winds of time. Finally, there is Sangha, the community of practice. Anyone who has tried to sustain a strong and regular practice apart from the support of such a community has probably learned how difficult that can be. When a Sangha is harmonious, when students support one another through the difficult hours of a sesshin, an intensive retreat, when there is no competition and jealousy, when the whole community maintains the practice with great care, Zen flourishes. Ultimately, though, whatever our Zen is, we must come to the place where it is no more. At that point, flowers bloom in the summer, leaves turn in the fall, snow blankets the ground in winter, and new grasses come forth in the spring.
So putting myself in the position of a person who's fresh to Zen, when you say that we must look into the mind essence, but then describe Zen practice as either just breathing, counting breaths, or answering koans, how is counting breaths looking into the mind essence?
That's a good question, an important question. Thank you. It is, because for the first time, we're kind of turning our awareness, our power of observation, inward to our own thoughts and to the activity of our mind. Prior to doing that, the stuff that happens in our mind just happens, and we're not even aware of it. Just constantly are reacting. But when we begin to look inward, and with that simplest practice, that breath counting practice, we begin to see how our mind is working and what our relationship to it is, and how our thoughts arise, how we chase those thoughts, how we become entangled in our own thinking, and how much that can distract us from our lives. And, you know, and I talked about last week also, the whole idea that another way of looking at Zen is looking at letting go. That one of the very important things we have to do is let go of our attachments, let go of the things that we're clinging to, let go of our judgments, and so on. And again, we're talking about kind of even when, as soon as we begin that breath practice, we're beginning practicing to let go. You know, a thought pops up, and we start to chase that thought. We have a little, you know, that little chain of thoughts beginning, and then all of a sudden we become aware of it. And whether we think that thought is important, or whether we think it's unimportant, whether it's ridiculous, whatever, it doesn't matter. We let it go. We come back to breathing again. We come back to counting. We come back to one. And that's so important, because it's loosening the hold of those thoughts. We don't have to be a victim of our thoughts. We have freedom, but we have to experience our freedom. So that's the beginning. Beginning is looking in, seeing what's going on, becoming aware of it, beginning to simply let go. Let go. Very powerful. If we did nothing else, our lives would change completely. Our lives do change completely. Did I answer that adequately?
That was a good answer. But I have another question.
You're too far away from me.
So, if you're looking in and you've had a set of thoughts, my foot hurts, fuck this, I'd rather be driving in my car. And then you think, oh, there it goes, thinking, you go right back to it. If you don't pause to think, oh, I'm dreaming of escape, you know, escape thinking or planning or anger or whatever, where does the moment of awareness come in? If it's simply dropping it without looking, even for a second, you know, in some schools they say having a thought. You catch yourself, you say having a thought. In other schools they say planning, self-justifying. So there's a label on it. So what's your personal relationship to that, to those different possibilities of catching yourself? And just going back, what you get from that is my mind wanders, or planning, which you get is something else comes from saying planning, putting a label on it. Which do you prefer?
Another good question. What did you drink this morning? I hadn't thought that through that way before. What I do think is this. Actually, my first training in meditation was Tibetan and Trungpa Rinpoche's. And they do use the thinking label. Every time you're distracted and you notice it, you say, oh, thinking, and you come back. At one level, I like that better than the particular thing, because number one, if I'm going with a particular thing, I got to sit there and think about what am I doing? You know what I mean? It's kind of I can get a little plot dance going on about, oh, am I planning, or am I really just thinking about lunch, or you know? So just everything is thinking. And the other thing is, I think there's a danger of possibly setting up a hierarchy if I start identifying different kinds of thoughts. That I'm thinking holy thoughts, so I can keep those, you know, and. So I think just all labeling it, all thinking, just poof, and make it go away. You know, it kind of keeps it all on the same plan. But that said, I also think the process works without any labeling at all. I think that just realizing, having that moment of, I'm not where I'm supposed to be, and I come back. The thinking label can help do that, but I don't think it's necessary. It's just having that momentary awareness that I'm not where I, you know, I'm off. I'm on my thought train, not on the counting of the breaths.
Joko Beck encourages her students to do the labeling as a way of learning about yourself and becoming familiar with, you know, how you get distracted and what sorts of things distract you.
One response to that would be, in retrospect, you finish your 20 minutes, half an hour, and you say to yourself, I was angry the whole time. So, and that's a sort of retrospective moment of reflection, of label. Whereas, and you, by postponing that labeling till the end, or noticing it, then you're avoiding doing what Peter was warning against. The minute you say planning, then that's sort of picking up the string again. It's picking up the string of thinking, rather than just dropping the thinking. But it seems to me that you could have that momentary flash of, particularly if you get used to it, planning drop. And perhaps that's a worthy way of doing it too. But I have to admit, I confess that I'm under the spell of mindfulness now. I've read a couple of books on it. And so...
No, there's a book called Mindfulness Now.
Mindfulness says, okay, you know, you reflect on it. Say, okay, there it is. I'm furious. I accept it. You know, I recognize it. There it is. Where am I feeling it in my body? And then letting go. So that their little process has three steps to it, and then it takes you back to it. But that, what you know, the limitation of that is it's happening outside of meditative situation. 99 times out of 100, you're going to forget to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't allow you that disciplined time just to meditate and have that more fundamental practice of letting go. Since in some ways, you know, Zen is wonderful because you can say, well, here's the heart of Zen, letting go, or here's the heart of Zen, compassion, or here's the heart of Zen, attention, or here's the, you know, Zen is a hologram, and the whole is implied in each one of its parts. But I just thought I'd raise those questions because I realized I sat for a long time without ever thinking, without ever thinking that through to any extent.
Yeah. I think the other thing that we want to remember is how hard it is to count from 1 to 10. When we start out, right, it's impossible, and after 20, 30 years of practice, it's impossible. You know, but, you know, but there's that level, first couple of things to that. So first of all, to me, you know, if I now said I've got to remember 3 steps every time I get lost, I'd be completely something. Yeah, but the other thing is, what we know both from scientific research and really from this idea, you know, from Zen teaching, is that it isn't staying on the numbers, for example, it's coming back. That's the important thing. It's letting go, come back. Let go, come back. If we never make it to 10, I mean, you know, it's, you know, we can go our whole lifetime and never make it to 10 and still have all the benefits of sitting Zazen. In fact, that may be actually a better thing than getting the, you know, if you start actually getting to 10, I've never had this experience, so I don't know, you know, then I can really attach to that. I can be like, oh, look at me, I can, you know, I can go to 10, 12 times in a row or something, you know. And I've heard people tell me that. People say, oh, yeah, you know, I can go to 10. I'm very jealous of that. You know, but it doesn't matter. But practice works for us just because we get drift off, we come back. We drift off, we come back.
Yeah, I think I agree that the labeling is extraneous. I think that the pure act of attention itself leads to that insight over time on a gut level without having to put the label on it. So if you're in a fiery, towering rage at somebody, and your attention happens to get on that, and you think, you don't even think, it's just like, oh, you know, and you're back. And sometimes for me, when I'm really lucky, rarely, there's this gut level like feeling that like this, you know, this isn't working. This is, you know, and just come back. And it's not, you know, I could sit and analyze and say, well, you know, rage, you know, or whatever, but it's not the thing I think that actually helps.
One of the things I've realized more and more lately, and I had a long conversation with Andy about this last night, is how many people with attention deficit are drawn to Zen. I think it's a very, very high percentage of people. And I think it improves, but it never goes away. Like, you know, but our relationship to our crazy mind changes, you know. And so, you know, it becomes a much more comfortable place. And probably calmer and quieter. But I think that, you know, part of that, you know, while there are these people who get to 10 with some consistency, they're not the ones with attention deficit, you know. And again, it's okay. It's okay. We're working. That's the other side of going to this mind essence. You know, each of us, in some ways, we're all the same, and in some ways, we're different. You know, and part of it is coming to accept who we are, what our minds are doing, what we're thinking. Our rage, you know, it's like we blame ourselves and judge ourselves because we have anger. I mean, I do, and probably we all do. You know, and that's this idea, like, well, especially if we're Buddhists, we shouldn't be angry. We get angry, you know? And so it's about working with it skillfully. It's about not, you know, acting it out, you know, and that's a challenge sometimes. But that's why we have to practice. Otherwise we'd become once and we'd be done, you know? We're always human. Always human.
That came up for me in a meeting that I had last week, where one member of the department was on the margins because she's the slide librarian, had her budget taken last year by my assistant. So she was really pissed off about that and hurt. And so we were having a meeting because the new budget's coming up. And we invited her, and then she invited someone else to be her advocate. And the person who's her advocate is the person who teaches Zen art. And she's not a practicing Buddhist, but she's steeped in it. So she came in and dropped an anger bomb. It said, this is, you know, I said we're here. The first thing I want to do is apologize, and then we'll see what we can do about this. She said, apologizing is not enough. This is an outrage. And she blew up. And then I said, well, let's look at the figures here. And then occasionally afterwards, she'd get all fired up again and says, well, this is an outrage. And finally I just said to her, you know, Anthony, you know, we're fixing this. And then she, okay. So the next day she said, I'm really sorry I was angry. And I said, no, your anger really was important to make the drama of this misfortune evident to everybody in the room, this injustice. And she said, and I appreciated it when you said, let go of it. But I actually said, I didn't say, you know, Anthony. I said, Anthony. And so I was angry at her. But she liked being called on it. Probably because she's had enough about Buddhism. So anger came and it went. And because we were straight about it, I think it was all to the good. She felt like she was defending somebody else, and she jumped in there in a righteous rage, I guess. But it was interesting how, you know, that she could drop it. Even if it came back up, she could drop it. If I had said it to somebody else, they would have probably been bullshit. But she knows enough about Buddhism. Anger comes and anger goes. The guy, Jack Kornfield's teacher, was with working with somebody who was absolutely pissed and was having, you know, recurrent, you know, fantasies and anger and all this. And what the teacher said was, anger comes, or no, compassion comes, and compassion goes. Hopefully it comes back.
Creations are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it.
Anybody up for tea?
Sure.
Okey-dokey. Nick, you want to throw some water on?
Yeah, please.
Inside the pot.
I was thinking throwing up here. But...
You better be fast.
Here, I'm off the kitty cats then.
Babies.
Stop moving your arm.